This episode is sponsored by Verisk Marketing Solutions. Verisk Marketing Solutions enables brands and platform partners to remove the guesswork around segmentation, timing, and messaging to help you continuously maintain a complete picture of your customers' and prospects' identity, attributes, and in-market behaviors as they change over time. Confidently personalize interactions to the right person at the right time. Visit marketing.verisk.com for more information.
And it's kind of giving Gemini a new kind of problem-solving skills based on interacting with the physical world as opposed to just being trained on internet data. And how it's doing that is actually it's fusing robotics and generative AI.
Hey, gang. It's Thursday, July 6th. From my voice, you can tell that it's the morning again. Why do we keep doing this? I hope you had nice long weekends. Garjo, Jacob, and listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily, an e-marketer podcast made possible by Verisk Marketing Solutions. I'm Marcus, and today I'm joined by one of our senior analysts on the connectivity and tech briefings, usually based out of New York. It's Garjo Sevilla.
Hi, Marcus. Hi, Jacob.
Hey, fella. Hello, hello. And also, we're joined by someone else on that connectivity and tech briefing team, one of our analysts based on the other coast in California. It's Jacob Bourne.
Morning, Marcus. Morning, Gadro.
Morning, fella. So, today's fact. I'm tired. But apart from that, the can opener wasn't invented until almost 50 years after the can. What's going on? So, the first way to open cans was using a hammer and chisel. The hell are we doing? Peter Durand, an English merchant, received the first patent for the idea of preserving food using tin cans back in 1810. And then for some ungodly reason, it took 50 years for the first modern day can opener that we know today to be created by an American inventor, patented by Ezra J. Warner. That's too long. I don't know how committed I would be to the can of alphabet spaghetti. Smash it open.
Oh. What happens when you don't have AI inventing things, I guess?
Exactly. So glad I was born later than this time. Let's just say that. Today's real topic, AI, regulation rumblings, Grammy rules, and chatbots eating themselves. So in today's episode, we'll cover how artificial intelligence might be governed and what happens when AI eats itself. Then for another news, we'll discuss the impact of Apple's Vision Pro MR headset. We start, of course, with the lead, talking AI. Let's kick off with some regulation. So US Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has launched an all-hands-on-deck push to regulate AI, writes Cristiano Lima of the Washington Post. He explains that the high-profile speech is expected to kick off a wave of legislative activity as lawmakers face pressure to set new protections to prevent AI from being abused. Mr. Schumer has dubbed the initiative the Safe Innovation Framework, with the name being an acronym for the goals of Security Accountability Foundations and Explain. One of his proposals is that a user should have the ability to ask how the AI chose its answer over another plausible option and where that information came from. So that's one thing that maybe we'll start with in terms of getting regulated. But gents, what are lawmakers most likely, in your opinion, to try and tackle first when it comes to AI regulation?
I think the first step would be to agree on the foundations and the parameters for regulation. And I mean, they would need to understand basically how the technology works on a much granular level than perhaps their legislative rules would suggest, mm-hmm. right? So, it remains to be seen if they can get the buy-in from AI leaders, because definitely that's going to be an important component. And if the lawmakers can set the groundwork based on that. Either way, I personally expect there to be a lot of back and forth, and it could take months to get, a working framework with all the parties involved.
Yeah. So, I mean, Jacob, there's a lot of places they could quote unquote start. I'm sure that there'll be lots of different rules coming out at the same time or within the same bill, but there's a few other US legislative efforts that are being kicked around, one centered around a bill requiring the US government to be transparent about using AI in interacting with the public, and they would let folks appeal decisions made by AI. That's one. There's a bill to establish an office to ensure the US remains a global AI front runner.
Right.
There's rules for testing AI systems before they are publicly available. There's protecting privacy rights. Where do you think they begin?
Yeah, I actually think that they're going to start narrow. So things like algorithmic bias, misinformation, copyright infringement are going to be kind of the initial steps. I mean, especially with the bias, that's something that's like kind of the age-old AI concern.
Yeah.
And we've already seen some tangible harm on that front. So I think that's going to be the initial focus. But I think, you know, you brought up a good point when you mentioned that bill for the, you know, the agency to help the U.S. stay, you know, an innovation frontrunner.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things that's happening around this call for AI regulation in the U.S. is actually, it seems like the government's kind of using it as an excuse to, you know, ensure that we see that it stays at the forefront of innovation. I mean, originally at that congressional hearing with OpenAI and IBM, that agency idea that was floated was actually an agency to provide AI industry oversight. And then it very quickly turned into to ensure innovation. So I think that's going to also be a running theme here is the U.S., you know, there's this call for regulation, but the U.S. does not want to fall behind, you know, China, especially on the AI front. And so while we will see some efforts to regulate it, I think the emphasis is actually going to be on innovation.
Yeah. Yeah. You were pointing out in an article you just wrote this, that there's a tough balancing act that they've got to try to figure out. I mean, Professor Yann LeCun, one of the three godfathers of AI, who is, Jacob, you said his title was?
He's a chief AI research scientist at Meta.
That's it. So he thinks each application would need its own rules, even. For example, different rules would govern AI systems in cars. Different rules would govern those that scan medical images. So this could get real messy, real quick, really expansive, real quick. The pace of regulation in the US, as we mentioned before, significantly trails the European Union. They've just advanced an AI bill that, after years of talks, called the AI Act, the first major law to regulate AI and a potential model for policymakers around the world. Adam Santariano of the New York Times was noting, well, what does the EU's AI Act include? A few things. So the European bill takes a risk-based approach to regulating AI, focusing on applications with the greatest potential for human harm. AI, for example, AI that operates critical infrastructure like water and energy, AI in legal systems, AI used when determining public services, government benefits. AI companies would also have to conduct risk assessments before putting the tech into everyday use. Think of drug approval processes. And then also, this bill would severely curtail the use of facial recognition software. They're still trying to iron that part out. And then also requiring makers of AI systems, ChatGPT, to disclose more about the data used to create their program. So just a couple of parts of this bill, major parts of this bill. What do we make of this bill? Was it got incredibly right, maybe a little bit wrong? Do we think this could actually be a model for others?
It's certainly very robust. Man, it's, you know, outside of China, one of the first, you know, very meaningful attempts to regulate AI. You know, it was first proposed back in April 2021. And, you know, we haven't seen it get passed yet, largely because there's been so much change in the AI industry, namely like the biggest change being the rise of generative AI.
I know they probably had a lot ironed out until then, and they were like, bloody
yes,
hell.
Absolutely.
Start
and so
again.
Now this, they had to kind of almost, you know, start from the drawing board
yeah.
here. And I think, you know, it's expected to pass by the end of the year. And I expect that we'll see further changes made to this draft in terms of how they approach this, you know, risk-based regulatory framework, whether they include general purpose foundational models within that. One of the things that they're asking tech companies to do is to publish summaries of copyrighted materials that's used in model training. And, you know, the people building these models are saying, you know, hey, this isn't technically feasible to do. And I think what they mean there is doing that would be so expensive. It would be too expensive in light of the other very high costs associated with training AI models. And it's something that they're seeing, they're looking at it and saying, this is going to be a further barrier to these AI startups becoming profitable.
Mm.
And so I think that's really going to be a sticking point.
There's that balance
in the,
again.
In that legislative process.
Yeah, balance between innovation and regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move from regulation to classifying AI. Juliana Kim of NPR notes that the Recording Academy, the organization behind the Grammy Awards, just outlined new rules for AI use ahead of next year's competition. First, Only human creators are eligible for the music industry's highest honor. Secondly, songs that include elements generated by AI can still be nominated, but there must be proof that a real person meaningfully, whatever that means, contributed to the song too. Harvey Mason Jr., the CEO of the Recording Academy, says, if there's an AI voice singing on the song or AI instrumentation, we'll consider it. But in a songwriting-based category, it has to have been written mostly by a human. I really don't know what that means. It seems like pretty ambiguous rules. But Gaja, is this not an example of how difficult it's going to be to classify what's using AI and to what degree?
Absolutely, especially in industries that are just supported by original content. So a classification system will be critical for musicians and creators just to ensure attribution and copyright. I mean, there's already a lot of instances where, there are copyright infringements just because songs sound alike. And, the argument there is they're using the same musical building blocks, right? With AI, I think it becomes a more complicated situation because there's so many ways AI can play into the creation of a song, whether it's the lyrics or the music. And it could be, I think, very difficult to really trace, the provenance of the original content in that respect.
Mm-hmm. So the US Copyright Office has issued updated guidance on submitting AI-assisted creative work for copyright consideration. And the guidelines, they ain't exactly crystal clear. So I went and looked at them. And so you have to, quote, describe the authorship that was contributed by a human. For example, an applicant who incorporates AI-generated text into a larger textual work should claim the portions of the textual work that is human-authored, and an applicant who creatively arranges the human and non-human content within a work should fit. I mean, if I haven't lost you yet, then you're really hanging on for dear life here. And then finally, applicants should not list an AI technology or the company that provided it as an author or co-author simply because they have used it when creating their work. So they're the incredibly clear rules.
Yeah. And it really adds a level of complication for artists as well to really understand what the rules are going to be. Also, just it's going to be complicated to create the full, framework for these rules.
Yeah. So why this all matters, why do we need to pass between human and AI created content? Well, the majority, nearly 90% of consumers want to know if they're interacting with something created by AI, according to Qualtrics. So it's something people are going to care about. Where did this come from? What's the source here? And that's what Chuck Schumer was saying. To go back to the lead, one of the most important things here is letting people know why AI chose one answer and where that information came from. Let's move to final part of our lead. And we're talking about AI systems eating themselves. So what happens when AI runs out of human-made content to hoover up? Well, generative AI programs may eventually consume material that was created by other machines with disastrous consequences, writes Matteo Wong of The Atlantic, pointing out that eventually these programs will have ingested almost every human-made bit of digital material that they're trained on. They're already being used to enlarge the web with their own machine-made content, which will only continue to proliferate. Mr. Wong thinks that to develop ever more advanced AI products, big tech might have no choice but to feed its programs AI-generated content versus human content, or just might not be able to sift human fodder from the synthetic, a potentially disastrous change in diet for both the models and the internet, according to researchers. So basically, AI is being trained on human stuff. When that runs out, it's going to have to start using stuff it's created itself. And what the hell happens then? So, I mean, Jacob, how big of a problem could AI eating up and learning from other AI content be?
Yeah, I think it could potentially be a very big problem. And one of the things we'll see happen is this kind of proliferation of low quality, redundant content, which is already kind of a problem for the internet and search engines, especially the quality piece of them. If the AI models already contain biases, then they're going to be regurgitating those biases and amplifying the problem. Same with the so-called AI hallucination problem, this kind of accuracy issue. If it's already producing inaccurate content and then your AIs are then trained on that inaccurate data, then it makes the problem exponentially worse. Now, one outcome I don't think is inevitable here is that this means that this flood of, you know, AI regurgitating data is going to mean that, you know, humans are going to lose their influence on the internet. I think we might see actually the opposite happen. And that's because it's really human-generated content that's required to provide a fresh source of data for AI model training. And so it's really actually a good thing for human workers. Mm-hmm. Now, one caveat to all of this is that actually what we're seeing is AI companies are looking to move away from just, you know, internet data as a source of training. For example, Google's DeepMind is building a new AI model called Gemini that it's hoping will actually surpass ChatGPT in capabilities. And it's kind of giving Gemini a new kind of problem-solving skills based on interacting with the physical world as opposed to just being trained on internet data. And how it's doing that is actually it's fusing robotics and generative AI. So basically, AI can now go out into the world and learn in a similar way that a human does.
Yeah. So Mr. Wong, really interesting article. I thought that him saying the problem with using AI output to train future AI is that despite the often incredible output from generative tools like image making Midjourney, they remain sometimes shockingly dysfunctional as their outputs are filled with biases, falsehoods, and absurdities. And Ilya Shumailov, a machine learning researcher at Oxford University, says those mistakes will migrate into future iterations of the programs. If you imagine this happening repeatedly, you will amplify errors over time. In a study on this phenomenon, not yet peer-reviewed, Shumailov and his co-authors described the conclusion of those amplified errors as model collapse, a generative process whereby over time models forget almost as if they are growing senile. This does not sound ideal at all. That's what we've got time for the lead. Time for the halftime report. Gajo, I'll start with you. What to you is most worth repeating from the first half?
I think the idea that U.S. lawmakers and, you know, many other legislative and regulatory bodies are moving fast towards trying to at least begin to understand what legislating AI is going to look like. And now, you know, it's become a huge challenge on all parts. But again, there's also this feeling that, you know, they need to do it expediently and sort of set the pace because it's still a competition across various regions.
Mm-hmm. Jacob?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're starting to see an initial fate outline for what AI regulation will eventually look like. I think it's going to take some time. But, you know, parallel to that is all these new questions that continuously surface, these hard to answer questions about, you know, the implications of AI, you know, such as what happened, you know, what's going to happen when it feasts on its own data, for example.
That's what we've got time for the first half. Time for the second today. In other news, just one story. New features for the Apple Vision Pro mixed reality headset emerge. Story one, the only story. We're talking about new features for the Apple Vision Pro. Apple recently announced its mixed reality headset, the Apple Vision Pro, with 2-hour battery life for $3,500, coming to the market early 2024 in the US. No controllers. The device is controlled using your hands, eyes, and voice. During its debut, Apple showed off features like projecting a huge movie screen in front of you or interacting with life-size personal photos or videos that digitally pop up in front of you. Now, a few weeks removed from this debut, Apple has said it's working on some new features. The headset centered around fitness and wellness apps, think features that track breathing during yoga class. The device might also get full-body 3D digital avatars and co-presence capabilities. What that means is using body trackers to help users feel like they're in the same room as other folks. Also using the mixed reality headset. This new Vision Pro device, though, does what for the AR headset market, Jacob?
Mm-hmm. The Vision Pro is still very much a work in progress. We've seen a preview at WWDC. However, you know, it's not launching till 2024, and there'll probably be some changes made before then. I think what is really important to know is Apple is devoting a lot of resources to a headset at a time when everybody else is focusing on AI. So I think it's a great thing for the virtual technology subsector. It also shows that the metaverse isn't dead. But I think one overarching question that looms large here is, once somebody spends $3,500 on a headset, how often are they going to be putting it on?
I would live in this thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it remains to be seen. How often do they put it on? How long do they wear it?
Yeah.
And it could be like what you're saying, Marcus, it'll be great for Apple if it's all the time. And the results of that are really going to be an important metric in terms of looking at, you know, the sales outlook as well as the outlook for a potential, you know, next generation model.
Yeah, time spent's a fascinating point. Yeah, people are not going to wear this thing all the time. I'm just saying that because it costs so much damn money.
Right.
I couldn't see myself ever wanting to take it off. But Gajo, what do you think?
Yeah, so while there are mixed reality headsets out there, few are being marketed as a spatial computer. So Apple actually sees this, you know, the same way they saw the first iPhone, which, you know, didn't have apps, it was quite limited, but it had potential. The thing is, it's being a spatial computer, it already has an attached developer content and app ecosystem. In Apple's case, it is establishing, you know, mixed reality as the platform for the next decade. So I do see it as a starting point. And, you know, there will be multiple generations of Apple headsets. And, you know, we're hoping they would become incrementally more affordable so they could be easily adopted into the mainstream. But, you know, as an alternative to PCs for very specialized applications and entertainment as well.
Yeah. Yeah, hundreds of thousands of apps that already exist on iOS being available through Vision OS. So they've got that ecosystem that people can plug into that they're familiar with. If you see someone at dinner with somebody else with one of these on their head, it's me. So we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much, gents, for hanging out. Thank you to Jacob.
Thank you, Marcus. Thanks, Gajo.
Thank you to Gajo.
Marcus, Jacob, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yes, indeed. And thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, Stuart, who runs the team, and thanks to everyone for listening in. We'll see you tomorrow, hopefully, for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an e-marketer podcast made possible by Verisk Marketing Solutions.